This week on Spectrum, Northern Ireland has dealt with more than a quarter century of the Troubles, violence, and death. We ask what part religion plays, and a young girl who has spent her life cringing from the violence around her Northern Ireland village reads her poem as she searches for peace. The Dead Sea Scrolls are on a roll. They're on display in the U.S. in a new golden age of availability, and new finds are putting a spotlight on the region where they were found. Human rights violations are studied, as they often are, but this time in the U.S. And as many people are celebrating Epiphany, the question is asked and answered, what are frankincense and myrrh anyway? With a forum of issues and news from the faith groups of our society, I'm Mike Hickox. Stay with us for Spectrum. A new study on TV violence shows children watching Saturday morning cartoons see an act of violence on the average of every 47 seconds. People watching prime time programs on commercial network and cable networks see violence about every 6 minutes. These numbers come from a major study of TV violence conducted at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. The project reviewed prime time shows on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox Network, and Saturday morning children's cartoons, and one night of programming on 12 cable channels. The project was done in cooperation with North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan, who has sponsored legislation to require the FCC to produce a quarterly report on violence, along with a corresponding list of sponsors of those programs. Moorhead College, where students, faculty, and staff were used to review the programming, is related to the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Churches across the U.S. are together calling for a curb to media violence. Frank Imhoff reports on this new national effort.
The National Council of Churches has adopted a policy statement called Violence in Electronic Media and Film. The director of public media for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, John Peterson, chaired the committee that drafted the policy.
We feel that it's a far-sighted and comprehensive document that allows people to enter into discussion and suggest some strategies.
Peterson says that everyone is already involved. As consumers, investors, or advertisers, he says the NCC statement calls on churches to be centers for media literacy, helping people see their roles in hacking away at the climate of media violence. Frank Imhoff, Chicago.
In a recent session with reporters for religious publications, President Bill Clinton said a spiritual change is the most important ingredient in the fight against real violence. During the one-hour interview, Clinton said turning around the violence would require a massive effort, including, he said, a spiritual change because government policies alone won't fix it. The president said many churches and religious congregations are already involved, but he challenged the religious community to do more to make the streets and the schools more secure. President Clinton, a Southern Baptist, went to second and third grades in a Catholic school. He was sent there for the discipline, according to his mother. Remember the city of Jericho? Remember Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and the walls came a-tumbling down? Well, these days, the walls are back up. Jericho is an oasis resort destined to become the temporary capital of the Palestinian autonomy. Sandy Gunner has a report on the status of the city of Jericho.
Jericho, the desert oasis located some 30 kilometers east of Jerusalem, has seen better days. Before the 1967 Six-Day War, it was a resort town for wealthy Arabs from all over the Middle East, dotted with garden restaurants and picturesque hotels. After the war, Israelis took the place of the Arab tourists and thronged the restaurants. The Intifada put an end to the good times, but now things are looking up again. The only tangible expression of these hopes so far is the construction of a small grocery store on the town's main recreation strip, Ain El Sultan Street. But the price of land on the strip has quadrupled within 2 months, from $40,000 to $160,000. So have prices of homes. The mayor of Jericho, Jamil Sabri Halaf, says he expects at least up to 10 new hotels to be built in the next few years. One plan, already in the blueprint stage, calls for construction of a 3-star motel beside one of Jericho's main tourism spots, Hisham's Palace. Osama Halev, who wants to build a large hotel complex on the site of the restaurant he closed during the Intifada, said Jericho should become the Las Vegas of Israel and Palestine. Mayor Halef has another dream. He wants to build a cable car from Jericho to the Mount of Temptations, where Jesus overcame Satan.
That report from Sandy Gunner of Israel Broadcasting Service. The Gallup Company compared results of its studies in the U.S. and in England and declared the U.S. to be the more religious. The survey found 94% of Americans say they believe in God or a universal spirit. In Britain, 70% say so. In the U.S., 84% believe Jesus is God or Son of God. In Britain, it's less than 50%. And church attendance? 43% of the population of the U.S. spends part of each week in a service of worship. Only 14% in Britain. This is Spectrum with news, issues, and stories from a spectrum of sources. Religious News Service, the National Council of Churches, Vatican Radio, Israel Broadcasting Service, Zondervan Radio Network, and from the studio of Spectrum, I'm Mike Hickox. For the past 24 years, Northern Ireland has been a dangerous place. On a recent very cold day, 50,000 people in Belfast and surrounding towns demonstrated for peace, but still the bombings and killings continue. And we ask, just what place does religion play in the hatred, and what place might it play in the resolution? Philippa Hitchens spoke with Richard Jenkins, a 25-year-old Anglican seminary student, and with Father Martin Kavanaugh, a Catholic priest. She begins her report with Father Kavanaugh.
I was home the weekend that the Shankill bomb went off. It was the first time. I remember coming back here and I was saying Mass for the community the following Thursday, and I spoke about having visited the north of Ireland, and I said, for the first time, and I lived there for 7 years, I said, for the first time, I said, I felt a sense of hopelessness. And I felt it in my friends as well, you know, that those families I was with that night.
Father Martin Kavanaugh is originally from Dublin in the south, the Republic of Ireland. But in 1981, he moved up north to the very Catholic town of Newry near Belfast to do vocation work among young people in that area. Young people, most of whom have known nothing but terrorism and a permanent military presence in their city. We use these kind of religious labels, but does religion really come into it or not? Or is it more, it's an identity label, isn't it, rather than a religious...
I mean, I hate to talk about Catholic and Protestant, I hate to talk about Republican and Loyalist, but unfortunately they're the tags that the media and everybody else uses. But I don't believe, you know, that it is either a religious conflict or it is totally a Republican versus Unionist conflict. It's about justice, that every man, every woman has a right to be treated equally before the law. And that doesn't happen in the north of Ireland. And it didn't happen in the past when the Unionist politics had control. And today, the Unionist people have a great fear and a legitimate fear that if they were to have a united Ireland tomorrow, that they then would suffer. They would be discriminated against. So, you know, the great idea of having peace talks and all of that, what Mr. Major and Albert Reynolds, the Taoiseach in the Republic, want to do, it's very laudable. But for the vast majority of people, their biggest problem is, can they trust the other side?
You say there's a very strong influence of the church, both churches, Catholic and Protestant.
Yes.
What do you feel about their influence to actually stop the violence? I mean, we've had very outspoken condemnations of the killings from Cardinal Daly, from Pope John Paul, even here in the Vatican on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
Do you think they have any weight on what's going on?
And also from Archbishop Eames, who's
the
Church of Ireland
Protestant,
Archbishop,
yes.
Because, you know, I mean, they're equally, you know, vocal in condemning. But, you see, we've had these statements, and powerful statements, but we've had them so often. Again, people don't really listen anymore, you know. We've become virtually immune to atrocities. We've become immune to, you know, murder.
Richard Jenkins was born and brought up in the Protestant part of Belfast. He's now training to become an Anglican minister, and he's currently on a 6-month ecumenical exchange program at the English College here in Rome. Richard, you're 25 years old. You've been around as long as the troubles, the latest round of troubles in Northern Ireland. For a quarter of a century, there's been nothing really but this stark division between the people who are labelled as Catholics and the people who are labelled as Protestants. Tell me, first of all, how much do you think religion does count in this conflict? Is it something that you grew up with feeling very much a Protestant as opposed to a Catholic, or is it something that goes deeper than that?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it. I grew up feeling a Protestant, and I grew up feeling very non-Catholic. Religion has a contribution to play in Northern Ireland, not because we're still fighting out Reformation battles, but because religion has a tribal significance. It's a good badge to wear. So if someone is from the other tribe, where they go to church is going to display that, and all sorts of other cultural tags as well.
And what about your family? Did they have Catholic friends or not? Or was it really that rigidly divided?
My mother would lament and notice the difference now between when she was brought up and Catholics and Protestants lived side by side in many areas without there really being a tension there. After the Civil War was over, after the partition, people just seemed to get on with it, she would say. We had a crucifix in my house, which was a very unusual thing for a Protestant household, because a Catholic friend had given it to my mother, and that was a very cherished possession. I have it in my room now. That's an important symbol, I think, of the possibilities that were there before the troubles at the late 60s and the splits between the communities since then. It's become polarised in my lifetime.
What is it that's going to change the mentality in, people your age who are getting married and having children of their own, what is it that's going to distinguish them to be able to change their mindset from that of their parents, perhaps, who didn't send them to a mixed school because it wasn't the right thing to do?
I think perhaps the experience of having grown up in the Troubles, of coming to an adult age and realising that you've known nothing other than this, and seeing that there's something better. My contemporaries are very often involved in cross-community work, my friends, in community work in theatre, in other forms of community arts and other activities and holidays and schemes and all of that, and those are real signs of hope.
That report comes our way from Philippa Hitchens and Vatican Radio. Both Richard Jenkins, the seminary student, and Father Martin Cavanaugh believe there are reasons for hope. Hope is what the young people in Northern Ireland yearn for. Almost 6 years ago, I spoke with several young teenagers from Northern Ireland. They were visiting the U.S. together. Some of the kids were Catholic, some Protestant, having a great adventure together, enjoying the U.S. and yet thinking about the troubles at home. One then 15-year-old girl, Karen Woods, wrote a poem about her feelings, about her frustrations over growing up in the midst of the Troubles. This is Karen. This is her poem called No Hope for Tomorrow, as she read it to me. This is the cry of a teenager.
I am afraid. Afraid of the land that I live in, that I was born in. The ground that I tread each day resounds with shots, with screams. It is saturated with tears, tears that have never ceased flowing. I have never known peace. Life has been full of murders. Then those condemnations, the people with power who condemn. Don't do anything, just condemn. And us with no power who want to fix it, cannot. What good is condemnation? Tell me, what will it do? How many innocent lives will it save? How many terrorists will it catch? Is there any hope? Prejudice is ruling here. Can we not all be one, Protestant and Catholic alike, all human? To solve it, we will have talks about talks about talks. I need a future.
Karen Woods of Carrickfergus, County Antrim, Northern Ireland. A biblical researcher says research on the Dead Sea Scrolls has entered into a golden age. Lawrence Schiffman is with the New York University Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. Schiffman told a conference in New York there is now total and open access to the scrolls, which were found in the Judean desert more than 40 years ago. Most of the scrolls were written during a period of 200 BC to 68 AD, and they include the earliest known copies of several biblical books. For the past 2 years, a bitter battle was waged between members of the scholarly team charged with editing and translating the scrolls and fragments, and other scholars who wanted access to the scrolls. Schiffman says the official publication team has now been expanded to 60 members and has speeded up translation and publication of texts. He also notes the increased use of technology, especially photography, computerized infrared, and computer imaging equipment, all which help recover otherwise illegible words. And scroll images will soon be available on CD-ROM for researchers working by computer. For both Christians and Jews, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 40s and 50s was the most exciting archaeological find in modern history. And now further excavation at the nearby Qumran community has turned up some new treasures. Myra Cohen tells us about the recent finds.
Israeli archaeologists excavating in Qumran near the Dead Sea have found more remains of the extensive Jewish presence in the Judean desert than they know what to do with. Since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in this area in 1948, the caves have been picked over and looted by Bedouin Arabs and antiquities robbers. But Amir Drori, director of the Israel Antiquities Authority, believed that more scrolls and artifacts were still there, waiting to be discovered. Dubbed Operation Scroll, the recent excavations conducted by 60 Israeli archaeologists, including one Arab, have in fact unearthed numerous artifacts that document the priceless Jewish heritage in the desert. The splendid and fascinating finds include the well-preserved remains of a warrior from the Canaanite period dating back 5,000 years. A bow and arrows, as well as a knife, were at his side. They also found a date press installation on the site where the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves were written. According to Yitzhak Magen, archaeological officer for the civil administration in Judea and Samaria, when the Bible speaks of a land of milk and honey, the honey it refers to is the sweetener made from dates. Other discoveries include a pottery shard embellished with a Hebrew inscription from the Bar Kokhba revolt in the year 132 of the Common Era, believed to be the only writing of that time, aside from papyrus fragments, that mention financial issues. There are also First Temple jewelry and remnants of a prayer shawl. To uncover these artifacts, the archaeologists resembled the daring and adventurous Indiana Jones, donning oxygen tanks, face masks, and helmets, carefully attaching themselves to rappelling ropes or aluminum ladders, and descending into the dark caves that dot the cliffs. The ancient Jews, seeking refuge from their enemies, had also used ropes to enter the caves. Since the Qumran area is to be part of the Palestinian Autonomous Region, some critics have labeled the excavations a last-ditch effort to extract Jewish relics from the Judean desert. Amir Drori disagrees. He says the excavations had been planned a long time ago so that archaeologists could learn more about the rich and ancient history of the Jewish people in the Judean desert.
Myra Cohen of Israel Broadcasting Service. I say human rights violations, and you think of Central America. You think of Eastern Europe. You think of Africa. Do you think of the United States? American human rights violations. Not an oxymoron? Here's a report from Roy Lloyd.
Over the next year, reports of human rights violations in the U.S. will be investigated through a project jointly sponsored by the World Council of Churches and the U.S. National Council of Churches. The campaign launched on Human Rights Day, December 10, was marked by simultaneous events around the country. The goal is to raise awareness by Americans about racism by placing the situations in the context of international human rights law. Dr. Deborah Robinson coordinates the program to combat racism of the World Council of Churches. She notes that Americans think human rights abuses occur elsewhere, not in the U.S. A team of eminent persons from around the world will listen to testimony and prepare a report so that Americans can hear how others view the U.S. human rights situation.
We think it's something for other places, but it's not related to here. So one part of the hearings will be a whole education component in the seven areas where we'll be, and then hopefully in years to come, a more national program looking at this. But I think it's important to lift this up to the international community. It's important for other countries and other international fora to understand what is happening in the U.S. because not only do we in the U.S. not know about human rights issues and human rights violations here, but churches and other people in other countries, they definitely don't know the situation in the U.S. And we feel it's really past time that these issues and concerns have been raised.
Why are the hearings being held now? Dr. Robinson, asked if something has changed that makes this the appropriate time to ask hard questions, responds,
not really. The idea has been around, and the need definitely has been around for quite a while. In fact, there was a lot of concern during the Republican administration that there had been such an erosion of civil rights and human rights issues that, and we saw the increase of ethnic violence and racial violence in this country, and just other persistent problems that have been around a long time. I think there are a number of dynamics of why it has taken us a little while to do it now. And even though we are quite pleased and optimistic with the new administration in their commitment to the issue of human rights and the domestic situation problems in this country, we still feel it's important to bring these issues to their attention and to the world's attention.
Two sites which figure prominently in the information gathering are Wounded Knee on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and Birmingham, Alabama, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. challenged racial policies and where he wrote Letter from a Birmingham Jail some 30 years ago.
The information gathered in the hearings will be used to write a very detailed and precise report that will be submitted to the UN Special Rapporteur on Racism. At the last Human Rights Commission meetings, there was a person who was appointed or identified to look at issues of racism worldwide. And by giving that person information, then we're in a sense asking that person to investigate human rights violations in this country. In addition, we'll be making an intervention, which is just basically giving testimony, at the UN Human Rights Commission meeting in February of 94.
Besides these goals, there is a broader and more compelling interest.
It's important also for the member churches, for the local congregations and the other groups and organizations in the United States to have materials that they can use very easily, I mean user-friendly type of material that would give the summary and the information, kind of a report on what we found in the U.S. and possibly what can be done about it, what they can do about it. And just, I think the first step of action is awareness. So first they must know what the issues are. And I don't think, I think the majority of communities here really don't know some of the problems and situations.
Dr. Deborah Robinson gives one example of what she considers a human rights violation.
I was in Georgia recently for a working group of the racial justice working group, and there was a toxic walking tour in one area, Gainesville, Georgia, and it was so clear that there was a main highway running through this area. Above, north of the highway was a predominantly white area. South of the highway was the minority and black area. And out of the 22 toxic sites, I think 20 of them were in the black area. And on one street, we walked down and they tied black ribbons, black bows, ribbons on the mailbox of every household who had a family member to die or be diagnosed with some form of cancer that's been shown to be related to these illnesses, given the environmental hazards in this area. And that was very graphic to see every mailbox had a black bow.
Whenever one digs into the dirty laundry of a people, there is bound to be indignation and criticism.
When you get close to the heart of something, you know, the more reaction you'll get from people who want to resist you getting to the heart. So my feeling is that probably the more resistance that we get probably means we're doing the right thing. We're really touching something here.
What's the bottom line?
We're really in this together, and if part of one segment of the population in the U.S. goes down and goes down further, we all go down.
the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches expect that exposure to international public opinion about the realities of life for ethnic and racial groups in the U.S. will have a positive impact on public policy, the general public, and most especially on the churches. In New York, this is Roy Lloyd of the National Council of Churches for Spectrum.
A San Francisco church has been barred from the annual meeting of California Southern Baptists because it has a woman pastor. In a close vote, 213-204, the assembly refused to seat the delegates of that church, saying female pastors are unscriptural. Critics of the vote say the exclusionary action is un-Baptist, noting that Southern Baptists have historically allowed autonomy to local congregations in choosing their pastors. The controversial pastor, the Reverend Julie Pennington Russell, was ordained by the 19th Avenue Baptist Church in San Francisco back in 1986. She became the pastor earlier in 1993. The World Council of Churches Executive Committee has approved grants of $360,000 to the World Council of Churches Special Fund to combat racism. The grants are designated for organizations working to combat racism. The largest grant, $100,000, was allocated to South Africa for liberation movements and other organizations to participate effectively in negotiation and the electoral processes. Do you remember what the three wise men are said to have brought to the baby Jesus? I'm sure you do. You remember gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And we all know the value of gold. But what about frankincense and myrrh? Let's check in with Myra Cohen. She'll know.
We all know that gold is a fitting tribute for a king, but frankincense and myrrh? What made them valuable enough to be included among the gifts the Magi brought to the infant Jesus? As it happens, they're pleasing and valuable aromatics, extracted from desert trees, used in biblical times for everything from making perfumes, burnt offerings, and wine flavorings, to embalming fluid. According to the Gospel of John, when Jesus was being prepared for the tomb, Nicodemus came with a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. Myrrh made cheap wine more palatable and was traditionally offered to the condemned before execution. It was offered to Jesus at Golgotha. The Gospel of Mark says, "And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh, but he received it not." Frankincense was even more valuable in biblical times. The prophet Isaiah predicted, "The multitude of camels from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense, and they shall show forth the praises of the Lord." And a passage from the book of Leviticus gives precise instructions on its use. "And he shall take his handful of the four, and of the oil, and all the frankincense thereof, and the priest shall burn a memorial of it, to be an offering made by fire of a sweet savor." Frankincense and myrrh were indeed precious gifts, as valuable as the gold the three wise men also offered to the infant Jesus during that first Christmas season so many centuries ago.
This is Spectrum, news, issues, and stories from the resources of many churches, denominations, and news services. Our theme music comes our way from the group Unu Mundo. If you have comments or questions about the program, get in touch with us at Spectrum. You can leave voice messages or send faxes. Call 603-332-3112. That's area code 603-332-3112. We'll be back next week. I'm Mike Hickox.